We resume with answers to oral questions. Question number 538, the Honourable Ian Simpson.
Mr. Speaker, can the government please advise the total growth debt as of the debt cost application of the sinking fund to growth debt, cash reserves, and net debt figures for public debt for the following dates being the 1st of July 2017?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Economic Development and Telecommunications.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer this question together with questions 539 to 544 and 553.
Question number 539, the Honourable Alan Clinton.
Mr. Speaker, can the government please advise the total liquid reserve figure and its constituents, namely consolidated funds, improvement surveillance funds, government companies, deposits, contingency, and other funds for foreign dates being the 1st of July 2017?
Question number 540, the Honourable Alan Clinton.
Mr. Speaker, can the government please advise how total liquid reserves and investors held, giving details of all bank savings bank accounts and cash flows for foreign dates being the 1st of July 2017.
Question number 541, the Honourable Ian Simpson.
Mr. Speaker, will the government confirm that it will, as per last year, provide a 6-month statement of revenue and expenditure to the 1st of September 2017, and if so, when is it anticipated it will be provided?
Question number 542, the Honourable Ian Simpson.
Mr. Speaker, can the government advise what financial oversight and monitoring will it perform over community care and its investment? And what are the latest audited accounts of community care and its companies that are in the government's possession?
543, the Honourable Ian Simpson.
Mr. Speaker, can the government advise if it is to introduce a new design for the draw for £1 coin, given that the UK £1 coin is to be withdrawn in October 2017?
Question 553, the Honourable Ian Simpson. My mistake. Question 544, the Honourable Ian Simpson.
Mr. Speaker, can the government advise the balance on the general sinking fund as at the 1st of July 2017?
Question number 553, the Honourable Ian Simpson.
Mr. Speaker, can the government advise how much the net £225 million raised from the mortgage of the housing estate has been spent and on what?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Economic Development and Telecommunications.
Mr. Speaker, the figures requested for the 1st of July are gross debt 447.7, DS funds 5.2, aggregate debt 442.5, 114.5, net 338. The position of regards to total liquid reserves, asset composition, when, where, and how these are invested on a particular day chosen by the member opposite continues to be as previously stated. The 6-month estimate of revenue and expenditure will be provided as per last year. Community care is an independent charity which was set up in November 1989 with the specific purpose of providing support to our senior citizens. No government since its inception has ever introduced any financial oversight or monitoring of the charity, and there is no intention to change it. As regards the audited accounts of the charity, I understand the most recent accounts after the year 2014-15. It is the intention to introduce a new design, one point the both of home. After that 553, there has been no change since the answer to question to 298 of 2017. Mr. Duke, I'm grateful to the Minister for the answer. If I can start perhaps with an easy question. 543, at one main point, if you recall, we did touch upon this in December 2016 in a supplementary to question 893, when we were discussing about the use of coins and coin machines in Gibraltar. Can the Minister give an indication as to when this coin is likely to be introduced? Given that obviously banks in Gibraltar are having to deal with the withdrawal of the old UK pound coin and the new design, and of course the Gibraltar pound coin, which is very similar to the old UK coin, and they have to literally eyeball these coins to separate them from the Gibraltar pound coin. Well, if you think of the problem. As I mentioned at the time, is the availability of the blanks, which are only available from the Royal Mint that produces them for themselves and sells it to the Tower Mint, which is the one that minted the Gibraltar coins. And in effect, until they tell us that they've got a sufficient quantity to spare, we're not able to fix the date. The position of the Royal Mint is not unreasonable. They've got a deadline of October, after which their coins will no longer be usable in shops. They clearly are using all the available supplies in order to be in a position to replace the millions and millions of coins that will become legal tender in October. Presumably, after October, the situation may improve because there will still be, it is calculated, several millions in the system that will be accepted at the mint, but will no longer be accepted in the retail trade. So hopefully, by the end of this year, they will have caught up with their own budget sufficiently to make blanks available for us. And then it would be the 2018 concept of the Volta that will include the new coin. In any concept, we do recommend that this year we will be using the old design of coin. I'm grateful to the Minister for the clarification. Has the government really already designed the new one-pound coin? Obviously, the volume in circulation is a lot lower than in the United Kingdom, so hopefully, we should be able to get some blanks off the Royal Mint in the UK. But have you already, already got the design prepared and just the question of taking an order? How long does it take between taking the order and receiving in terms of lead time to receiving coin? It takes a couple of months to get the design approved, in fact. It's a lengthy process. The designs are usually produced by the mint. We don't have anybody doing designs in Gibraltar. We give the theme to the mint, and the mint produces a number of designs which is looked by the Minister of Finance, who is responsible for taking the design, and then it goes to the government, and then it goes to the palace, and then the palace is back to the Foreign Office, the Foreign Office is to the government, the Foreign Office is doing it for finance, and then it comes to me, and eventually the coin is done. So the whole process takes 6 to 8 weeks. And we're not at the start of that process because it will be, when we do a new coin, it won't be the only thing we do. We will do an entire new set with that new coin, and we see there are any other changes in the United Kingdom in the offering. For 2008, which we will incorporate at the same time. But our points clearly are going to become a legal tender for the value.
Yes,
obviously, I'd like to submit the comprehensive response. Just going on to question 541, in terms of I'm grateful that you will give another 6 month statement of any expenditure. In terms of when we could expect it, would it be January of this year? I'm sorry, I didn't follow what it is in the presentation. Question 541, the 6 month segment revenue expenditure. Could you expect it in January 2018 as you did this year? I think we got it in January, February 2018. It was slightly delayed, but the expectation is the same as the expectation of last year, that it should be. Is it really driven by how late things come in? Because, in fact, once the treasury is satisfied that the figure for September is reasonably accurate in terms of how close it is to the estimate, that it may be over the estimate in some areas, then they don't expect that there will be stuff in the pipeline which has to be purchased. But in historically, by December, it's reached a point where you can be fairly comfortable about the level of accuracy. Again, very good to meet you for his confirmation of that. James, question 542. Is the government saying that in terms of the community care charity, which I recognize as an independent charity, that you've not received information regularly from the charity? Did I hear incorrectly in saying the last account of 14-15, which I presume would be to June 2015? It's not so much about when our funds are finished or not finished, but it relates to the commitment of the payments that we got from the number of people that are receiving payments. But the information is based predominantly on us looking at what are the requirements that they are facing in terms of our commitments for household tax allowance, for community offices, for the widow's benefit. Those are the things that they keep us informed about, because, you know, monitoring that gives us the picture of the liabilities that are going to be the recurrent expenditure. It has to be understood that we have got a commitment to provide them with money every year, which we have to be confident will be over what they're likely to be needing spending, because the commitment of this government is to increase those reserves. And therefore, before, the position was that the government of the GSB, we did not have the same commitment to maintain the reserves, so their interest was to be sure that they were not running out of cash, because they were not putting money in unless it was that the reserves had been discussed. But to my knowledge, the level of information that the government gets today is the level that I used to get in 1989, and the level that was given to the previous government in the intervening 15 years. And it's always been thought important that the connection between the government and the charity should be as minimal as possible for several existence. Just to clarify, the last account of housing is actually the date of June 2015. To my knowledge, the last account that they were auditing was 14-15, but I'm not saying it was in a government system, because I don't think it necessarily means that they actually give us an account every year. You know? But for us, what are the last accounts that have been done and have been told from the charity 14-15? And finally, Mr. Speaker, I don't want to go on too long about things, but does the government have any, any guidelines, have any expectations in terms of how community care would be invested in its surplus?
The historical position has always been that community care
deposits its surplus funds in the savings bank, that is the deposit bank.
Question 545, the Honourable Alex Jones.
Mr. Speaker, can the government provide a list of the information for each financial year of contractors of the government to build contractor schemes under individual trade?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Economic Development and Telecommunications.
No, Mr. Speaker.
Mr. Speaker, may I ask why? I understand that perhaps going back to financial year may be complicated, but perhaps the Minister would be able to provide a list as of now or as of the commencement of this financial year.
Mr. Speaker, I wouldn't be able to provide him with the figure at the commencement of each financial year. Unless I knew that it was each financial year since the last election, or each financial year since the previous election, or each financial year since 1972 when I came in, or each financial year since 1704 when we captured the Volta. But in any event, we don't do the list by financial year, that is to say. When I ask, they tell me that they're not able to tell me, for example, who was on the list 6 months ago. The list is added to or removed from. In addition, at the moment, the list is being expanded in the sense that it started off, as the Honourable Member may know from this question that I answered, going back a couple of years, some since it's been here and some before. The original figure that we inherited in 2011 was 91 companies, who were the companies that were on the approved construction list that had that special arrangement that was introduced in 2010, where in order to be able to get construction work from the government, you had to be on a list and you had to commit yourself to keeping your accounts up to date, to pay the social insurance, and to give priority of employment to unemployed persons provided by the employment service to the company. And unless those conditions were met, you were taken off a list. That didn't mean you couldn't work as a construction company, but you were taken off the list of a company that could do work for the government. We found that this is not being universally applied, and therefore we actually expanded the construction list in our time. Some because about 35 or 40 new companies were created by small people who were unemployed, who had been in the construction industry, mainly people who were in their 50s and therefore had difficulty in competing, and we helped them to set up little companies, and those 30 or 40 companies were added to the list. And then since then, the other issue which I explained previously to the former leader of the opposition when he raised it with me was that there are companies, of course, that are put on the list only for the period that they're doing work here, because they are non-deposit companies that are allowed to come in on specific contracts, but we only put them on the list in order to complete the contract that they have obtained. So, for example, if we got a contract that goes out and they bring in specialist subcontractors for the marina, the contractor for the marina has to become a member of the approved contractors. And instead of having a definite date, it will say until the completion of the work on the marina, and then it drops out of the list. So, you know, the first, there's nothing significant about the beginning of the financial year. What I can do is, at the moment, in addition to it, there is the computerization that is taking place in the procurement office, and we're going to finish up with one list which is electronic, and which will cover every contractor and every supplier. And that may even be publicly available for anybody can, you know, log in and see. But in addition, when that is ready, I will provide the honorable member with it. I haven't been more now than to tell him what it was a week ago, but that wouldn't mean anything because it's in the process of being expanded and being put in the electronic system.
Question 546, the Honourable Ms. Andy Hassan.
Can the Minister for Employment confirm if the scheme still exists, providing numbers of employees, or if it has been replaced by employing individuals through a recruitment agency?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Economic Development and Telecommunications.
Mr. Speaker, when we weigh the question of grant, I am unable to decipher what scheme in particular the Honourable Member has in mind, although it is not for me to teach him how to draft parliamentary questions. Given that the clue is that it is a scheme that has something to do with employment, I am assuming that the question is about the so-called vocational training scheme operated by the DSC government, which existed in December 2011 when I became Minister for Employment. I know of no other scheme related to employment. The Honourable Lady wants to know whether it is still in existence in 2017, and if that's what you want, then I must say I'm astonished that you submit to ask a question. What I ask myself is, where was the Honourable Lady in 2011? Indeed, where has she been since 2011? I appreciate, of course, that there is no evidence that before she arrived in this place, by hitching a wagon to the GSD, and shortly afterwards, unhitching it, the Honourable Lady took any interest in schemes related to employment or anything else happening in this parliament. Now that she's unhitched from the GSD, it appears that she sees herself as a future first female chief minister and believes that this is the result from what she claims to have introduced, namely a new style of political debate in this chamber, to the support of which our citizens are flocking in masses. I have to acknowledge that she has brought something new to this parliament, exemplified by the content of this question. This is a level of ignorance that I find is unprecedented in the short time she has been there, here, and indeed the long time that I have. Given how little she knows about the fate of the defunct vocational training scheme and how it came about, I will enlighten her so that at least in this area her knowledge will be enhanced. Although the vocational training scheme, which was in place up to 2011, was linked to employment, it did not actually have any employees as such. There were a few hundred individuals who were placed predominantly in the private sector, but with a significant number in the public sector, who were not deemed to be in employment with anybody. That is, they had no employer and were not subject to employment law. They had no employment contract. They had none of the entitlements to leave or anything else that the law provides. They were paid an allowance instead of a wage, which was, however, well below the national minimum wage. These students, for want of a better name, ranged from school leavers to, in one particular case, an individual in the city. When the students left the school, which generally was after 6 months, but in some cases lasted for several years, they had no guarantee of employment, and it was a matter for the private sector employer whether they chose to offer them a job or not. Those placed in the public sector were not guaranteed employment either, although a few did get taken on. But I remember one particular case where a person was terminated from the scheme after 7 years and was not able to do anything about it because he had not been employed by the scheme. All this was fully debated and argued in the public domain in the 2011 general election, when one of the most debated policy differences between the parties was the defense by the GSD, then in government, of the scheme that they had, the vocational training scheme, and the commitment on our side that we would cut it if elected to government and replace it with a strategy, which we called the future job strategy, which in effect would be creating specific training companies, pay the national minimum wage, provide a contract of employment to all those then in the GSD scheme, and to other people wishing to be considered from the unemployment list. The training company came into effect on the 1st of February 2012, as I had promised that they would during the 2011 election campaign, and have been operating since and continuing operations. This is public information, which the Honourable Lady should know from the fact that questions have been asked when she's been in this house regarding the persons that are in the training company in anticipation of getting jobs in the private sector, where the difference, apart from the fact that while in training they are employees of the company, lies in the commitment of the part of the employer with whom the training has been placed to employ them at the end of the agreed period. These are partnership agreements with firms in the private sector, which have led to an increase in private sector employment since 2012 for locals in areas where previously employers might have relied on imported labor. So the program says that the only scheme that has ever existed, which are connected with employment, was the vocational training scheme, which was discontinued in January 2012 and had been operated by the GSE administration, that the persons who were in the scheme in January 2012 were transferred into training companies and given contracts of employment in these training companies, and those training companies continue to this day. All this, of course, is not new and has been raised many times in the course of the last parliament and since the 2015 general election.
Mr. Speaker, I'm sorry to see that the Minister for Employment and Trade has treated my question in such an unnecessary, defensive, and personal style by bringing up my past, my future, which he has decided I am gunning for. I don't know if the Honourable Gentleman knows me well enough, but he seems to, and my style. I was also just told by the Honourable Gentleman that I have all of a sudden developed an interest in employment. Let me just say to the Honourable Gentleman, as well as to every member of this House, that my only interest, I always repeat this when people try to trip me up as such, is people. So whether it's swimming, flying, employment, health, education, or finance, that is where I will be. And that is what I think is my job, despite whatever the Minister is trying to accuse me of. And the only scheme that I was actually talking about was the Future Job Strategy, which is a scheme that this administration of today came up with in 2011, that promised to those young students, to those students who were there. And it is those students who feel treated and feel that they've been given false hopes in part through the representation that comes to me. It's not something that I am inventing, and I think that the Minister, with respect, would do well to accept that these complaints are coming to me, and this is why I am representing it in this Parliament. And these are the questions relating to the Future Job Strategy that I was bringing up. That was the data I was trying to gather. And it's unfortunate that you've spent so much time trying to judge me and come up with the things that, you know, I think are relevant to this question. But the point was that I was trying to make is that there are a lot of discontent. There is a lot of discontent among youngsters. And I would have tried to ask the Minister, what is going on with the Future Job Strategy? Is it sustainable? And why is there a correlation between the complaint of the Future Job Strategy with the increase in recruitment companies?
Well, I regret to say that supplementary only increases my conviction that he doesn't have a clue what he's talking about. I don't know what complaints there are. The original question was asking if for me to confirm if the scheme still exists. Well, the Future Job Strategy is not a scheme. It is a label that we attach to the creation of a company that employs people who before they were employed in that company were previously unemployed. The concept of the scheme is that something that disappeared in 2012. He doesn't seem to know that, because otherwise he wouldn't have been using terminology which is not applicable. Secondly, he wants to know if it still exists. Well, there is no scheme that exists. There is a company that exists, and she should know that it exists because she's been sitting where she's sitting there and sitting somewhere else before that and has questions about the fact that there are people there. And if she has a doubt about whether it exists, then that is in conflict with the supplementary that the people that are in the scheme that she doesn't know whether it exists or it doesn't go to complain to her. If it didn't exist, there wouldn't be anybody there and nobody could complain to her. So I'm afraid that the question doesn't make any sense because it what she thinks is that there are no longer people being taken on in the training company, notwithstanding the fact that we provide people here to say what there are. Then the second part of the question doesn't apply because obviously, if you think that they have the training companies don't exist and have been replaced by recruitment agencies, which I find very strange, the answer is the training companies, if that's what you want to know, still exist. And I've already answered that in my original question. There's no indication here of anybody complaining about anything. But if you have some complaint about something from somebody, then I think if you have put a question originally, which reflected the complaint that you had, I'm sure nobody's coming to say, ask if the scheme in which I am working still exists. Because I will be coming on with a person to the last time. So he assumed, presumably, that the training companies must stop existing and they were not doing it anymore. And if that's an assumption that you've made, then it's incorrect. And if that is something she has been told, then she's been told incorrect information.
Mr. Speaker, once again, the minister accuses me of not knowing what I'm saying, and perhaps when you don't know something, it's a good time to ask a question, which is why I brought the question to Parliament. If constituents are telling me or asking me, is this scheme still exists? Is the future job strategy still viable? Because they're not hearing anything, and they're not going anywhere with it. And I come to Parliament to ask the Minister what's going on with that. I'm sorry that the Minister answered me in this way because all I'm trying to do and give him the space to answer these questions to these constituents, and these are the type of answers that I get in return. I don't think it's such a bad thing that I'm coming here to ask for the question. I still don't have any of the answers, clearly, really. And now that I will finish off with a question, if we are talking about the GSB, as you said, your government changed the scheme, but you closed that side of the way that the GSB used to do things. Where is the training aspect that the GSB used to provide, which clearly is not happening today?
The honourable member stands up and says things that either she knows are not true. And I don't want to say that because that is something you don't do in this house. You don't say to people you're not telling the truth. Okay? So I don't want to say that. And therefore, I am left with only one alternative. If she doesn't know that what she's saying is not true, it means she thinks it's true. And she says, where is the training that used to be done with the GSB? Where was she? Where was she when I gave the breakdown of the training of the construction and on a good bed that is going on when I was answering questions from Mr. Phillips? Where was she? That you think that we stopped that training in 2011 and it's been going on all the time? It was going on before and it went after. We didn't stop the training of the people involved in the construction. We doubled the pay of the people who were there and we gave them a contract of employment. And before they were treated as if they were in school with an allowance of £300 a month, and we came in and we gave them the minimum wage, which is then just under £1,000 a month. We gave them a contract of employment. We gave them the right to protection against employment injury. We gave them the right to annual leave. We gave them the right to public holidays. We treated them as workers. In fact, we introduced the national minimum wage at the age of 15. And we are paying our apprentices in Gibraltar almost double what they get paid in the UK. Now, I know they may be complaining to her about it, because people in Gibraltar are notorious for complaining if they take you over the gate. That doesn't surprise me. But the point is that she thinks to him, Elbert will discontinue training, notwithstanding the fact that the information is in the public domain and has been given in this parliament. And secondly, she's speculating in our original question that the training companies have disappeared altogether. Well, I cannot understand as I can justify the nature of a question on the basis that is what people tell her, which is bringing to my attention, because the question implies that people are telling her, we're not being trained anymore. Well, if they're not being trained anymore, tell me I want to know because I'm paying for them to be trained. Or, we are not being employed anymore, and then I would want to know what's happening with the money that I'm providing for wages. So, people are getting paid every month, and people are receiving training every month. Some of the training is in training centers, and some of the training is in the job where an employer commits to taking on the person, and the commitment, as I've explained many times, is done on the basis that we guarantee the first month to everybody, irrespective of how little training there is, so that the person do not have the argument saying, well, look, I have to, for example, in some areas, employers can say, well, look, I have to provide a uniform, and then I find out that after the first few weeks, the person is failing to turn up for work and everything else, I'm going to take a new employee, so there's a very high turnover. Like many employees in the private sector say to us that the people from the unemployment list, we don't necessarily believe it. Maybe there are some cases are, but it's not true of everybody, are less reliable than people who come across the border. Well, obviously, one thing that is true, I've been an immigrant worker in UK, and when you're an immigrant worker somewhere else, I suppose you are more worried about losing your job than when you are in your home territory. But the fact is that providing through the company for the payment of wages for a period of time, while the person is being trained and acquainted with the nature of the work, means that in the period when theoretically the worker is less productive because he's not familiar with the job, we provide the necessary financial incentives to encourage private sector employers to employ the volunteers. That we monitor by looking at the degree to which we have got more devotarians in the private sector in employment. We haven't, it's not been a huge increase, especially because not everybody wants to work in the private sector, and certainly because there wasn't a huge increase of labor available anyway. But there has been an increase in the number of people in the private sector. It's still happening, and we're still employing people, and we're still paying them. So if he was more specific in pinpointing what it is that she thinks is happening now, which has led her to say whether the companies have been replaced, then I might be able to provide her with concrete answers to specific questions. But at the moment, the things that she said in her last supplementary are no more accurate than what she said at the beginning. It is not true of discontinued training, and it's not true that the companies are underemployed people. It's driven by demand. So we say to an employer when they open a vacancy, look, we've got some person here that may have some previous experience of working in this industry. And if you're willing to take him on instead of asking for permission to bring in somebody from outside, we are prepared to make that attractive for the company financially by providing financial help. Some of it we do with our own money, some of it we do with EU money. That is what is being done before, during the GSD years, and it was being done by the GSP, who was the first government in Gibraltar to achieve money from EU, from the social assistance, from the social fund for employment. It was the GSP government that brought this to Gibraltar, and it carried on throughout the years of the GSD, and it carried out with us, and it was partly Gibraltar money and partly EU funding, and still there. And it will go on, presumably, until 2019. And then after 2019, what we have said is it will have to be 100% funded by us. because we're not going to stop it when the union is stopped giving us money.
What's the next question? We now move to answer questions for Chief Minister. We commence with question number 460, the Honourable Ed.
The Canada Government provided a service since December 2011 of information technology work carried out, which has not been carried out by the Government Information Technology and Logistics Department and across the resource.
Answer you over the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, before I start that, can I just point out for those who are not in the House, that this is a question posed to the Honourable Minister for comments on our position of rules. Or wait until there is an answer to dealing with the questions posed to him. Mr. Speaker, the information cannot be provided in the time available since the question was asked. On many occasions, there is an overlap between the purchase of equipment and services provided by the company that supply the equipment, making the determination even more challenging. To provide the information for 1 year alone is a challenge, to go back 5 years considerably more.
The Honourable Chief Minister guide me and perhaps rephrasing the question by perhaps providing a cap on the cost of the work, could that perhaps provide an answer in the future if I table this question again?
Mr. Speaker, I'm not yet advising, but I will do what I can. And for example, I would suggest to him that if you look at the estimate book, there will be the cost of the complement of this department, and then there will be funding available for other work. Perhaps if we ask for a breakdown of the type of other works which are undertaken by that department, we might there be able to see the work is work undertaken by the department itself and work undertaken by third parties. But I used to carry this portfolio, and I can tell you, for example, that the way the government accounting works, you might find that the ICOD department is paying the Gibraltar Electricity Authority for work that's done by the Gibraltar Electricity Authority. So you'll see a lot of that in the context of that breakdown. That is likely easily accessible for the years that's gone and the year in which we're in, and that might be an easier way of understanding how that department spends the money which is not spent on the salaries of the people in that department, especially who are the ones working themselves at ICO.
Answer the question number 461, the Honourable Aaron Tinker.
Mr. Speaker, can the government advise that it has a sole shareholder approved the audit of accounts of the Gibraltar International Bank Limited for the year ended 31st of December 2016?
Answer the Honourable Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, no, sir. Mr. Speaker, on record, the Chief Minister will answer. Is it possible for him to explain why the government has not yet approved the annual audit of accounts? Mr. Speaker, because the annual general meeting has not yet been called. Mr. Speaker, the Chief Minister will be aware that the audit of accounts obviously exists. The SSC has a copy. They are not being filed upon the House, presumably because a sole shareholder that hasn't been approved. Does he have an idea of when the AGM might be called? I do, sir. And Mr. Speaker, the great Chief Minister can enlighten us as to when that would be. No, Mr. Speaker, because I have an idea of when it might be called. It is not something that is fixed in time. It might change. And I don't want to give this information which may turn out not to be correct. Mr. Speaker, as anybody working for financial services and will tell you, banks usually compete with each other to file their accounts promptly. can the chief minister indicate if in his thinking this meeting would occur before the end of the year? And Mr. Speaker, it's not from my thinking, because I'm not the person who's going to be attending the annual general meeting or whose timetable is relevant, but the information I have at the moment is that it will happen during the course of this calendar year.
Question number 462, the Honourable Aaron Clinton.
Mr. Speaker, can the government advise why to keep the capital restructuring of the Gibraltar Central Bank when it is proposed to convert its authorised share capital into two classes, namely an A class of voting rights and a B class of non-voting rights, and what is the purpose?
Answer the Honourable Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, the capital restructuring of the Gibraltar Central Bank is carried out pursuant to advice received under the approval of the Financial Secretary. As the Honourable Member knows, the new shareholder with the Government of Gibraltar is the Gibraltar Development Corporation, a government-owned company, and its investment in the bank is entirely consistent with its objectives. And Mr. Speaker, relative to the Minister's answer, and indeed, filing from this house, in September, shows that the Digital Development Corporation has indeed subscribed for £6 million of share capital, or indeed shares of the Gibraltar Central Bank. If I may ask the Chief Minister, why is this money not routed through the Improvement and Development Fund? I think it was the government's say it should not be, it should be routed in the way that it was routed.
Question number 537, the Honourable T.M.
Mr. Speaker, could the government say what is the latest projected date for the completion of the runway tunnel project, including associated roads?
Answer the Honourable Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, the situation has not changed since the reply given in answer to question 223 of 2017. Which is that the completion date for the runway tunnel project is expected to be in the first quarter of 2019. The associated roads will also be completed by that time.
Question number 548, the Honourable T.M. Hughes.
Mr. Speaker, how much cooking oil was imported from 1st of September 2016 to the 1st of August 2017?
Answer the Honourable Chief Minister.
Because cooking oil is presently imported under other foodstuffs, AF, in the customs tariff. For example, Morrison's imports most of its food products as other foodstuffs, or other foodstuffs as AF. Otherwise, their customs declarations will be very time consuming to complete and an administrative nightmare to check, is one of the companies an example. I'm therefore unable to single out cooking oil and extract that data for the Honourable Gentleman.
Speaker, bearing in mind, obviously, the importance of recycling the possible products such as cooking oil, particularly as opposed to other foodstuffs of whatever nature they may be, would the government consider actually separating out items such as cooking oil in this case, just so that we can monitor how much is coming in and compare those figures with the amounts being collected and we get an idea of what they're being disposed of by means other than inappropriate? The most appropriate means it is usually chemical, and only ask that question for government consideration.
Mr. Speaker, as I understand it, unless the foodstuffs are specifically required to be declared, there is no ability to drill down into the foodstuff imported. So I could not answer the question today with more particularity in relation to cooking oil, as I would not be able to answer any possible cookie dough, for example, or Smarties. That's probably a brand name, I think, Mahenson, but particularly chocolate, with a particular variety coated lightly with sugar and bright colours. The reasoning there is not entirely a national thinking. There is an international customs tariff which, under WTO style rules, applies between countries that subscribe to the United Nations tariff structure, the customs structure, and there is a sense of excellence in respect of customs practice, the United Nations customs practice, at work because the rest of which we are all being proud. So it is not, therefore, entirely in my view, given that I know of the subject, which is superficial, possible to do that. But I would definitely go back and check whether it is possible to, going forward, seek to require specific declaration of an item, and whether there is a good reason that we should do that in relation to cooking oil, and if it has to consult with the Honourable Minister of the Environment in order to make an informed decision.
Question 539, the Honourable Tillemann.
Mr. Speaker, has Government given consideration as to when it might enact the buyback clause on the bus fleet, and if so, when might that be?
Answer the Honourable Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, yes, sir. So, Mr. Speaker, from that answer, I am saying that consideration has been given. Is it the Chief Minister telling me that he's not willing to answer the second part of the question as to when it may be?
Mr. Speaker, given something consideration, which is that the Honourable Government has asked me whether the government has done, is not to say that one has reached a conclusion or decision. And therefore, it is not that there is a consequence if so when, which runs from the first part of his question. He has asked us whether we have given consideration, and I've given the answer that we have given consideration. There is no consequence if so when that the desire is closed.
Is the Chief Minister, and I thought the Chief Minister's answer, and I followed up in the way I did for clarification and charity over the point I was asking, is there any limitation on the buyback in terms of time? Does it expire at any point within the contract, or is it open-ended and it would be a valid termination now as it may be at the moment?
From memory, I am not able to give that information. The Honourable Gentleman asked next month, and after I'll be able to come with the details.
Question number 550, the Honourable Aaron Casey.
Mr. Speaker, can the government advise whether the Gibraltar ID card will still be a valid travel document when in the UK post Brexit?
Answer the Honourable Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, at this stage, the Brexit in the Brexit negotiations, it is not possible to answer this question beyond speculation. The issue will, however, clearly be a bilateral one for the bulk of the United Kingdom. Mr. Speaker, I raise this question because of keeping us vaguely aware in a recently released UK government document where it kind of indicated that national ID cards may not be accepted as valid travel documents in the United Kingdom. I just ask the Chief Minister to bear that in mind for the future negotiations.
Mr. Speaker, I'm grateful that you think that he needs to bring matters to attention for the listed issues. This is very much something that has already been the subject of consideration and has been a matter which, for the past 2.5 years, we have been dealing with in the context of heat maps, etc., that were prepared by the Office of the Deputy Chief Minister with their usual efficiency. Mr. Speaker, if he does think that there is an important point to bring to our attention for the negotiation, can I just say to him that the best way to do it in the interest of the British people at home and the call up is to write this to me if he wishes, because I know his inevitable decisions on the letter about how parliamentary and how urgent the letter may be, up to him. But if something is important for the voter in his view, as he says it is, and it is for the negotiations to be devoted in the United Kingdom, if I'm a person with respect,
otherwise could remind the Chief Minister who was that person at committee about these matters to be discussed. I would urge them to convene sooner rather than later. Well, Mr. Speaker, I was surprised that the Chief Minister could ask me here, I think, from the Minister of Committee, and if he had thought it appropriate that we could have a meeting with the committee that we had in the first myself or the Deputy Minister, and ask that we convene one. And we have just come out of a period of recess in the United Kingdom. We have been in continued contact with colleagues in the UK, and maybe material to brief, or there may not be material to brief until after the party conferences. But, Mr. Speaker, this does not obviate the point I'm making to him. If he thinks something is important to the voter, then the best thing to do is to tell us about it directly and not put a question in the floor of the House. Otherwise, I'm interested in discussing that this is something that is important for him to highlight, but he is highlighting.
Question number 551, the Honourable Ian Clinton.
Mr. Speaker, has the government commissioned any research paper into the Chief Order and Good Governance Clause in the Devolved Constitution Order 2016? And if so, from whom, for what purpose, and at what cost?
I'm for the Honourable Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, the government is undertaking work on an analysis of that aspect of the Constitution. The analysis has been undertaken by Dr. Hakeem Youssef at the University of Birmingham School of Law. Dr. Youssef is not charging for his work. His personal cost of research assistance undertaking the necessary and civil work amounts to a total of £52,286.60.
I'm going to be able to come back to the point. I didn't quite catch the purpose for the research paper.
Mr. Speaker, it's an analysis in respect of that aspect of the Constitution.
Mr. Speaker, I may ask the Speaker why they don't feel a need for something in my office.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I'd be quite happy to brief him behind the Speaker's chair rather than here. I mean, if the Honourable Gentleman thinks that it makes sense to have that debate just before the House, I don't think he knows what his words mean or what they've been used for in the past.
Question number 552, the Honourable Aaron Clinton.
Mr. Speaker, can the government advise how it intends to manage the introduction of Gibraltar's own Great Repeal Bill in respect of Brexit and what consultations are envisaged?
Time for the Honourable Chief Minister.
The government will make a statement in due course about how it intends to manage the introduction of a bill in respect of the repeal of Gibraltar's European Community Act. It will be premature to say more at this stage.
Question number 554, the Honourable Ian Clinton.
Mr. Speaker, over to the Minister for Housing. June 2017 budget speech. Can the government advise what were the technical difficulties in respect of infrastructure that caused a delay in the affordable housing scheme? And what are the terms and footprints? And when will a detailed announcement be made in respect to the affordable housing scheme?
Answer the Honourable Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer this 555.
Question number 555, the Honourable LSDM.
Mr. Speaker, can the government provide an update on its affordable housing and government rental project?
Answer the Honourable Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, an announcement on the new affordable housing scheme will be made before the end of September. The changes in the technical issues that they write will be behind them.
Mr. Speaker, and that is into a full answer. Is there anything especially technical difficulties that are in any way confidential that can be disclosed this last month?
Mr. Speaker, the technical issues that give rise to the changes will be apparent when we make the statement. And when we make the statement, the Honourable Gentleman will be able to understand what the reasoning behind the decision to move away from the original design and the geographic changes arises from. If you're going to be able to confirm that the style of 1780 and operation needs are going ahead, albeit perhaps in a different footprint. Mr. Speaker, as I have already said, in fact, I believe I confirmed that during the budget session, the key question of the Honourable Gentleman is not an identical term, but almost identical term.
Question 556, the Honourable Ellison.
Mr. Speaker, did the government consider installing an escalator between the coach park at Midland Park and the bus floor level in the same building?
Answer the Honourable Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, will answer with questions 557 to 564.
Question number 557, the Honourable Ellison.
Mr. Speaker, why did the government not install disability, elderly, and time-friendly doors at the Midland Park?
Question number 558, the Honourable Ellison.
Mr. Speaker, can the government disclose the contract and intervention between the government and the cleaning company and the Midland Park?
Question number 559, the Honourable Ellison.
Either can the government say which company is responsible for cleaning and maintenance of the Midland Parking?
Question number 560, the Honourable Ellison.
Mr. Speaker, can the government say how much revenue has been collected on the sale of car parking spaces in the Midland Parking?
Question number 561, the Honourable Ellison.
Mr. Speaker, can the government provide a monthly schedule of how much has been paid to the company responsible for cleaning and car parking?
Question number 562, the Honourable Ellison.
Mr. Speaker, can the government provide a monthly schedule of revenue received from each pair of the solar stations since April 2012?
Question number 562, the Honourable Ellison.
Mr. Speaker, can the government state how much revenue has been collected per month for rental car parking spaces and midtown parking spaces for stations?
Question number 564, the Honourable Ellison.
Mr. Speaker, can the government provide a monthly breakdown of revenue received from public parking and midtown parking spaces for stations?
Answer the Honourable Chief Minister.
The content of the monthly rollover agreement between both parties at a cost of £4,900 per month for three cleaning agents. The total revenue generated from the sale of car parking spaces with Midland Park is £9,029,500. The information requested by the Honourable Member in respect of his other questions set out in the schedule, I will now hand over to him. Mr. Speaker, with reference to question 557, the Honourable Chief Minister states that the doors are wide enough to accommodate a wheelchair and pram and suitable for the elderly. However, they're extremely heavy and only 2 minutes ago in city place, we saw a wheelchair user trying to open the doors and saying that the doors were probably the heaviest he'd had to maneuver with. Is it not possible to adapt these doors
given him a new bill, and he's given him information that has been taken into consideration with him. That being sold, should that be automatic, or will an automatic feature on them in order to enable wheelchair users in particular, as well as the elderly and parents with prams, to access the building in a much more friendly way?
Well, the thing I was struck by that, and it's something that has been looked into. I don't think necessarily this is the sort of facility we've seen in car parks, because car park stores have a particular characteristics, which are a requirement as to fire retardant capabilities. But it's only that it's been looked at in the context of ensuring that those types of difficulties can be married with the requirement for the doors to be of a particular weight and size.
Question number 565, the Honourable Elephant.
Mr. Speaker, can the government disclose how many boats have been imported since they raised the import duty on boats and the value of these?
Answer the Honourable Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer this by success.
Question number 566, the Honourable Elephant.
Mr. Speaker, can the government disclose since December 2011 how much import duty has been paid regarding the importation of boats?
Answer the Honourable Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, since the 1st of July 2015, a total of 907 vessels import licenses have been issued with a total value of $16,312,295, that is the date of the waiver. Between the 9th of December 2011 and the waiver of import duty, 207,895 was collected over the 3.5 calendar years.
Question number 567, the Honourable Elephant.
Mr.
Speaker, can the government disclose what the estimated import duty revenue would have been for the construction, fishing out and equipping of interior ways and plaza had it not been waived?
Answer the Honourable Chief Minister.
Well, it's about £440.66. Going back to a question asked back in June by the leader of the opposition, the reason for waiving the import duty was explained as having been paramount for the project to have proceeded. £2,440 was there for months of pushing the developer enough in order to complete the project. Could the chief minister explain the rationale behind the 442.
Mr. Speaker, I'm told that Imperial Ocean Plaza is presently in burial of strike, and that the work done there has been of very little value, and that the import of equipment etc. has been very minor, and therefore that's why the figure is 440 parts of the city. Any information I get from the city is about the names of the ocean village towers as well.
Would the Chief Minister know what the estimated import duty would be for the project and the figure that the government considered at the time of whether we waived import duty or not?
Mr. Speaker, I don't have that number with me. I don't know whether the calculation is based on the period from Friday or is it based on the gross development value and an extrapolation from there, which is not something that the developer gives us that we consider. But it's not in the sector of Imperial Ocean Plaza and its particular city now, etc. It's not based on a greater or description of what the particular developer may eventually issue publicly as the setting out that they will do that. I think it's based more on an analysis by the financial secretary's office of what is the
type of accommodation that we've seen at the moment. Is it the sort of accommodation for which we would approve categories of citizenship? And therefore, what is the sort of square metre cost? What is the gross development value? What is therefore the potential of building materials that will be the potential value of building materials that will be used, and therefore what extrapolation can we do from that? And that analysis I don't have with me today for this particular project. But I can't recall entirely the if I may just remind one of the gentlemen in the second message that were discussed at length in this place and in fact in the media at the time that we were first elected and at the time of the 2011 general election. From memory, and I know from the memory of the second minister, but no more than that, I would have to go back and look at it in detail. The waiver of import duty in respect of Ocean Village project was a waiver entered into in a composite agreement entered into between the former administration and the developers, the Ocean Village developers, not by this administration. So maybe that we inherited that aspect of the calculation. And what the slogan is to keep it, either because it was relevant for the banking of the project, which all developers say these waivers are, and or, in addition, because we might have had advice to suggest that this was a commitment already entered into on which the developer had detrimentally relied, which is the reason. But I cannot exactly remember talking about this particular tower, what the issue was. I just engage one final time as a speaker. If I table the question for next month, would it be something to be able to provide the estimated figure for this particular tower? With all the caveats that I have given this particular proposal, it may be something that's in a DeFi, i.e., a file to which I do not have access, and I will endeavor to do so if it is possible.
Question number 568, the Honourable Eric Jones.
The speaker can be done in state what the monthly rent is for the Gibraltar Oil Deposit is at the World Trade Center and who is it paid to?
Answer the Honourable Deputy Minister.
The speaker rent is 569.
Question number 569, the Honourable Ellis Young.
The speaker can be done in state what the monthly rent is for the Gibraltar Oil Deposit was in the Irish Sound Station and who is it paid to?
Answer the Honourable Chief
Minister. Mr. Speaker, the monthly rentals paid by the Audit Office in the Irish Town Location under a licence was £8,007.64. The monthly rental payable by the Audit Office at the World Trade Centre is information that is publicly available on the body.
Question number 570, the Honourable Ellis Young.
The Speaker, can the government state how many employees have been physically based at number 6 on the place in each month of the year since April 2012?
Answer the Honourable Chief Minister.
Well, answer is 571.
Question number 571, the Honourable Ellis Young.
The Speaker, can the government state what the internal and external area of number 6 has been placed on before the refurbishment and what it is following the refurbishment?
Answer the Honourable Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, beyond the complement numbers set out in the estimate book, it would now be impossible to provide the figures of who was based at the number 6 Condon Place in earlier financial years with any degree of accuracy. The internal and external area of number 6 Condon Place before the refurbishment was 1,173 square metres and 149 square metres. The internal and external area of number 6 Condon Place after the refurbishment was 3,380 square metres and 987 square metres respectively.
Question number 572, the Honourable Ella Fleming.
Mr. Speaker, can the government disclose whether they have directly or indirectly provided any financial assistance to the Voter One Vote Limited?
Answer, the Honourable Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, the government has not provided any financial assistance to the Voter One Vote Limited.
Question number 573, the Honourable Alex Fleming.
Mr. Speaker, can the government provide details of its plans as a form of response?
Answer, the Honourable Chief Minister.
Maybe we'll talk about funding today, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, I will answer together with question 574 to 576.
Question number 574, the Honourable Alex Fleming.
Mr. Speaker, can the government provide an update to the answer provided in question 209 of 2017?
Question number 575, the Honourable Elephant.
Mr. Speaker, can the government state what is happening with the Eastside development?
Question 576, the Honourable Ms. M.D. Hassan.
Can government inform the House if there have been any developments on the Blue Water project at the East Side?
Answer, the Honourable Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, negotiations as to the future development in the site are ongoing.
Answers to written questions, the Honourable Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I have been honoured to table the answers to written questions W116/2017 to W130/2017.
First and second reading.
Mr. Speaker, before we start the process of dealing with bills, I propose that the House should recess for 10 minutes.
We now have a 10 minute recess. A bill for an act to regulate the provision of legal services in and from within Gibraltar, to make provision for and in connection with the creation, membership and functions of the legal services regulatory authority, to make provision with respect to disciplinary matters in respect of the conduct of lawyers, to provide for and in connection with the incorporation, membership and functions of the Law Council of Gibraltar, and for connected purposes. Therewith, the Honourable the Minister for Health, Care and Justice. Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move that a bill for an act to regulate the provision of legal services in and from within Gibraltar to make provision for and in connection with the creation, membership and function of a legal services regulatory authority, to make provision with respect to disciplinary matters in respect of the conduct of lawyers, provide for and in connection with the incorporation, membership and function of the Law Council of Gibraltar and the purposes connected therewith, be read in first time.
I now put a question, which is that a bill for an act to regulate the provision of legal services in and from within Gibraltar, to make provision for and in connection with the creation, membership and function of the legal services regulatory authority, to make provision with respect to disciplinary matters and respect to the conduct of lawyers, to provide for and in connection with the incorporation, membership and function of the Law Council of Gibraltar, and for purposes connected therewith, be read a first time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried.
The Legal Services Act 2017. Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move that the bill be now read a second time. Mr. Speaker, as you know, a last minute amendment has arisen, most of which I have given to you, and copies of which have been circulated to members of the House. As honourable members will know, the government has a long-standing commitment to reviewing the current system of regulation of legal services in Gibraltar to achieve a modernised and comprehensive system. But this review is necessary, is not in doubt. The current law has not been fundamentally reviewed for 50 years and requires modernisation and amendment, mainly because it has not kept pace with the growth of the legal profession and the current working environment. What is more, the current law does not fully reflect the huge nature of legal practice in Gibraltar, nor does it cater for the clear regulation of persons providing legal services who are not barristers or solicitors in private practice. For example, government lawyers, in-house counsel, legal executives, and law courts draftsmen. To that end, the government consulted with all relevant stakeholders, including the Honourable Chief Justice and the Bar Council, to ascertain how 50 years of reform could be undertaken. The Bar Council, in particular its chairman, Chief Justice QC, has proved to be the driving force behind this much needed reform, and it is their work which culminated in the first draft of the bill, and it's been submitted to me, which forms the backbone of this bill, which is before Parliament today. Mr. Speaker, the bill has been through two rounds of public consultation undertaken in conjunction with the Bar Council, and it is a testament to the hard work and sensible approach of the Council that the final version is in very similar terms to the first draft they submitted. As I mentioned, Mr. Speaker, the objective of the bill is to provide an overhaul of the regulation of legal services. This will achieve an intelligible, comprehensive, modern, and effective regulatory system which defines the provisions of legal services, provides for the registration of authorised persons, being such persons as will be authorised under the Act to provide legal services, establishes a registered authorised persons for them, places the successor to the Bar Council on a statutory footing, establishes a legal services regulatory authority, enables the making of subsidiary legislation, govern matters of discipline, conduct and practice for providers of legal services, provides a system of statutory exemptions in defined cases, and allows for the provision of legal services through an expanded form of practice not currently provided for in law. As lawyers in Parliament will know, the admission and enrollment of barristers and solicitors to the Supreme Court is governed by the Supreme Court Act 1960. The way the act is drafted means that potentially there are people who may fall outside the current statutory regime, but who are nonetheless arguably providing legal services in Gibraltar. The new registry system is therefore governed by the petitioners, government lawyers, in-house counsel, legal executives, and law clerks' draftsmen. It also clearly provides that an authorised and non-exempt person cannot provide legal services. The bill, however, does provide a system of statutory exemptions for persons regulated under the Act, regulated under other Acts, or other qualified persons to enable them to continue to provide core services within the scope of their respective professional activities. Mr. Speaker, the bill is an umbrella piece of legislation under which subsidiary legislation governing professional conduct, discipline, committed to the council, practice and certificates, regulations, and other matters relating to the provision of legal services will now fall under. You will, for example, Mr. Speaker, be aware that the Bar Council has already published a draft code of conduct for consultation purposes so that they will be ready to hit the floor running when the bill becomes law. Given the fact that the bill has in various forms been the subject of two rounds of consultation, I do not intend to go to the bill on its forward by forward basis. Rather, I will summarise the main parts and highlights of the bill. Part 2 of the bill and pages 1 and 2 of the bill draw from the English Budget Act of 2007 with amendments to adapt these to our particular local circumstances. In Part 3, there is an explanation for what falls under providing legal services for the purposes of the Act. Under Part 3, a person provides legal services is not being an exempt person who does all or any of the matters set out in the paragraph A to F contained therein. These are very comprehensive and, for the first time, explicitly contain references to in-house lawyers, etc., government-employed lawyers, and legal executives. The definition of reserved legal activity is contained in Clause 4 and includes the exercise of rights of audience, the conduct of litigation, probate, the provision of legal advice or assistance under water law, in connection with the application of water law, or with any form of a solution of legal dispute, and the provision of representation in connection with any matter concerning application of water law, or any form of resolution of legal dispute. The file of the new regime will be the Register of Authorised Persons, which is created and maintained under Clause 6 of the bill. The Register consists of a number of parts to allow persons who intend to provide legal services to register as authorised persons. The various parts of the Register are as follows. 1. Private practitioners who are in practice in Gibraltar. 2. Foreign counsel called for specific cases. 3. Government lawyers. 4. Legal executives who work for part-time lawyers. 5. In-house counsel working for companies, businesses, trade unions, statutory authorities, or other bodies. 6. Legal executives who work for companies, businesses, trade unions, statutory authorities, or other bodies. 7. Law clerks, and 8. EEA or registered European lawyers. The bill further provides that law practices can offer via partnership, corporate entities, or limited liability partnerships, and must register in Part 9. Subsidiary legislation will set out more detailed provisions in respect of Part 9 registration. Mr. Speaker, applicants for registration will require to pay a registration fee, which will finance the LSRA and the Law Council's activities, and will need to comply with any code of conduct under the Act. Registration and the different parts of the Register provide a clear of rights as set out in the bill, with each part having different rights and duties. Exemptions are provided for by Clause 7 of the bill, and particularly by Schedule 2 of the bill. Persons who are regulated by other laws in Gibraltar or other specified persons are exempt from the provisions of the Act and may provide services specified in Schedule 2. For example, persons regulated by the Financial Services Commission and the Council may provide certain services that would technically fall within the definition of legal services. Mr. Speaker, moving on to Part 2 of the bill, we see provision for the establishment of a legal services regulatory authority, which specifically is governed by Schedule 2 of the bill. The general functions of the LSRA are set out in Clause 15. It will have wide-ranging functions, including powers to regulate the provision of legal services, to protect and promote the interests of consumers, to encourage an independent, strong, diverse, and effective legal profession, regulate the provision of legal services. The regulation includes the administration of rules in relation to practice, discipline of conduct of authorized persons, the application, registration, and removal of authorized persons in the register, the application and issue of practicing certificates to authorized persons, and monitoring the adequacy of anti-money laundering and anti-terrorist financing systems maintained by authorized persons. The process of investigation of disciplinary matters is governed by Part 4 of the bill. A full procedure for making complaints and investigating them is set out, and a new disciplinary tribunal is established, which will perform its function through disciplinary panels. Mandatory tribunal may, by way of an interim measure, suspend in place conditions on or revoke the authorised person's statutory certificate and ban him or her from providing legal services, undertaking restricted legal activities in Gibraltar, and in addition, may recommend to the Chief Justice and apply for the authorised person to be set off the roll of the court, impose a fine on the authorised person, administer any reprimand to the authorised person, order the authorised person to repay or forgo a fee, and order the authorised person to make a payment of or towards the cost of investigation capped at £20,000. Appeal from the decisions of the disciplinary tribunal will lie to the Chief Justice or some other judge designated from him. Mr. Speaker, Part 5, the final part of the bill, other than constitutional and consequential provisions, places what is currently known as the Bar Council on its statutory footing, renaming it as the Law Council. The change of nomenclature is not merely cosmetic, but it is intended to reflect the fact that the Law Council, as it will become known, is a body representative not just of the Bar, but solicitors, in-house counsel, legal executives, and law court judges, complement with the regulation of the overall provision of legal services. The Law Council has diverse advisory, consultative, and policy-making functions, and through its offices on the LFLA, the system making powers. The LFLA will hold regulatory functions, where the Law Council will retain its role in respect of representation, policy-making, promotion, and marketing. Membership of the Law Council is automatic on registration in the register established under the bill. The constitution of the Law Council is modelled on the current Bar Council constitution with necessary revisions. It is included in Schedule 5 of the bill. Mr. Speaker, in conclusion, the bill provides a welcome and necessary update to our law in this area. The Bar Council and relevant stakeholders are confident that the fundamental review contained in the bill ensures that our legislation regulating our legal profession reflects the key nature of the profession and the members now involved at different levels and roles. It is, Mr. Speaker, one of those occasions where all stakeholders are agreed that change needs to take place and the direction that such reforms must take. It is not change that makes life necessarily easier for the stakeholders. In fact, it is important to note that those stakeholders are taking on duties and responsibilities which today have fallen to others and are doing so in order to ensure that our jurisdiction's legal profession is well regulated and fit for purpose, with robust systems in place to protect consumers and the public and ensure that international and domestic responsibilities are met. The Speaker, the bill is the culmination of much hard work, not least by members of the Bar Council, and two valuable and informative consultation processes from members of the legal profession, all with a degree of positivity and a sense of awareness of the value of the exercise, worked together to produce this government bill. Mr. Speaker, I'd like to take the opportunity to thank the Honourable Chief Justice, the Bar Council, the Attorney General, and all stakeholders involved in the bill. It has been a team effort, and one of this on the senior side to have been a part. Mr. Speaker, I commend the bill to you.
Before I put the question, is there any honourable member wish to speak on the general principles and merits of this bill? The Honourable Lady Phillips.
Mr. Speaker, before I make my short contribution on behalf of Her Majesty's Royal Opposition, I must of course declare an interest in that my firm and the lawyers at my firm will of course be materially affected by this new proposed legislation. We, together with other law firms, have been closely involved in the consultation process on the bill and have offered the Bar Council from time to time, as currently constituted, our views on the bill and the code. I was also a long-standing committee member of the Bar Council at various points in time when this bill and the original concept of the regulation hit the Bar Council and it exploded before I put my seat in his hand. The bill, and I agree with the main member of the Minister for Justice, represents the most significant piece of legislation passing through this House to affect the legal profession in 50 years. And I'm honoured and privileged as a member of this House and a member of the Bar to support this bill. And we on this side of the House will be unanimously supporting the bill for its various stages today. The way in which our legal profession offers its services has changed beyond recognition in the last 50 years, and we need to respond. bill will, amongst other things, further strengthen the disciplinary powers that apply to legal practitioners, introduce a more modern regime for the continued education and training of legal practitioners, and it's also focused importantly and to the leader of the opposition is delight, I'm sure, the involvement of lay people in the LFRA, which I believe is critical in the delivery of a modern regulatory regime which has at its heart a service to the consumer. The bill will also ensure that the LFRA will accept and promote in the public interest standards of behaviour and professional performance. The above reforms represent a substantial change, Mr. Speaker, in the way in which lawyers conduct their business. At the same time, the government has strengthened the law by the creation of a regulatory body to enforce professional standards and obligations. This approach to reform will result in a vibrant and robust legal services market that will be a benefit to the consumer, and at the same time, will ensure that consumers are not exposed to any increased risk of inappropriate behaviour and poor performance. The bill demonstrates that reform can be of mutual benefit to the legal profession, businesses, consumers, and the community at large. Finally, Mr. Speaker, we must thank the profession and the members of the Bar Council, past and present, for the work that has been done to produce an excellent piece of legislation. In particular, the staff must record its gratitude to the 2019 for its drive and determination in seeing through this reform in this area. We can also thank the Legislative Drafting Team for their work, the Chief Justice and the Attorney General. Therefore, we will join the government in commending the bill to the House.
Any other honourable member wish to speak on the second reading of the bill? The honourable Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I think it's arising on behalf of the office that I hold to thank all those that the honourable Mr. Costa has indicated have been of assistance in the context of preparing the bill without falling into the trap of campaigning for anyone who might be putting an info within a particular post, but to thank everyone who's been involved in producing a text that the whole House can get behind, and which I think would provide a better regulation of the legal profession, and which is not something that happens every day. This is, in my view, a seminal piece of legislation that will change legal regulatory framework in a positive, modern, and forward-looking way. And I'm especially on behalf of the government to thank the Honourable Minister Costa for the work that he has done, driving this legislative enactment in the way that he drives everything, which is also entirely positive and designed to produce a result that everybody can support.
Move over to the ground.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I want to thank the Honourable Mr. Phillips for the comments that he has made and his supporting support for the bill. And of course, as well, Mr. Speaker, to thank the Honourable Leonard Stanley, who has been a great to see kind remarks.
And so I now put the question, which is that a bill for an act to regulate the provision of legal services in and from within Gibraltar, to make provisions for and in connection with the creation, membership and functions of the Legal Services Regulatory Authority, to make provisions with respect to disciplinary matters in respect of the conduct of lawyers, to provide for and in connection with the incorporation, membership and functions of the Law Council of Gibraltar, and for purposes connected therewith, be read a second time. Those in favour? Those against? The Legal Services Act 2017.
Mr. Speaker, I beg to give notice of the committee state and third reading of the bill be taken today with all honourable members agreed.
Do all honourable members agree that the committee state and third reading of the bill be taken today?
Committee state and third reading.
I have large news that House and I have all itself into committee to consider the following bills forward by floor, namely the Legal Services Reform Act 2017.
a bill for an act to amend. A bill for an act to regulate the provision of legal services in and from within Gibraltar, to make provision for and in connection with the creation, membership and functions of a legal services regulatory authority, to make provisions with respect to disciplinary matters in respect of the conduct of lawyers, to provide for and in connection with the incorporation, membership and functions of the Law Council of Gibraltar, and for purposes connected therewith. Part 1, clauses 1 to 2.
Stand part of the bill.
Part 2, clauses 3 to 5.
Stand part of the bill.
Clause 6 is amended.
Clause 6, a small amendment has been circulated, if the honourable members have. Would you like perhaps to suggest, it says in subclause 4 of clause 6, perhaps that should read in subclause bracket 4. Change that, subclause bracket 4, as circulated. Do all honourable members support the amendment? Aye, so we move that. Clause 6, as amended, stands part of the bill.
Clauses 7 to 13
stand part of the bill.
Part 3, clauses 14 to 25
stand part of the bill.
Part 4, clauses 26 to 29
stand part of the bill.
Part 5, clauses 30 to 37
stand part of the bill.
Part 6, clauses 38 to 41
stand part of the bill.
Schedules 1 to 5,
stand part of the bill.
The long title,
stand part of the bill.
The article reports that the legal services bill 2017 has been considered in committee and agreed to with amendments, and I now move that it be read a third time.
I now put the question, which is that the legal services bill 2017 be read a third time and carried. All in favour?
Aye.
Those against? Carried.
Well, Mr. Speaker, in an attempt to be able to get back to monthly meetings of the House after the difficulties that we have had with the budget referendum, where the House agreed that we would not be meeting monthly, and the aftermath thereof, which is something that made meeting monthly difficult, it is the government's intention to continue now the pace of monthly meetings we have established. In order to do that this month, Mr. Speaker, and to deal with the remaining most of the taxes and some bills that are on the order paper, we have to do a very tricky exercise, given that we are straddling the happy period of the holidays, the Navarans, who are members of the Jewish community in Gibraltar, who will be celebrating the Jewish New Year tomorrow and on Friday. And I understand from the member that we will go to Cox in the first week of October. And also attendance of ministers at the Labour Party conference and the Conservative Party conference and the SNP Party conference and also at the United Nations. And therefore, I'm going to propose, Mr. Speaker, that the House should now adjourn to Tuesday the 10th of October at 10 a.m. while still in bills and motions. It is my intention that on Tuesday the 10th of October we will take the motions that are in the order paper, and that I will, as soon as we finish, give notice of the next meeting. So I'm expecting to deal with business on Tuesday the 10th, again senior deal on Tuesday the 10th at some time, and then immediately, either during the course of that day or the next day, give notice for the October meeting. So we will then have a session on the 10th of October for business relating to the September meeting, a
well, there I'm speaking of the issues that London members would be aware of. I will relate, of course, to the celebration of the Gibraltar Day event in London, which I understand by the last full week of October. And so we will have to try and see how we can marry the monthly meetings with all of that without the power and the events at the end of October, while still intending to come back over for a full meeting in November and December this year. And so, Mr. Speaker, with that explanation, I hope you get assistance from you. But at the start of the House and to members of it, I now move that the House will adjourn to Tuesday, the 10th of October at 10 a.m.
The House will now adjourn to Tuesday, the 10th of October at 10 a.m.